Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Dana Theos. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today. Why don't you tell us about that, Colin?
Yes. First, we have Kim McCabe, who is president and CEO of ASI Government. Then we have Ahmed Ali, who is president and chairman of Tista Science Technology Corporation. Then Jason Bloomberg, who is president of ZapThink. And Frank Sherman, who's CEO of Transportation Management Services, Inc.
Thank you. And first up is Kim McCabe, who's the president and CEO of ASI Government. What is ASI Government, Kim?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show today. I'm really glad to be here. ASI Government has been around about 17 years, about a $60 million company, about 300 folks who are incredibly passionate about government service, particularly about acquisition, helping the government to figure out what to buy, help them buy it, and help them get the value from what they bought.
And why is that so important, especially now?
Well, right now, the government is looking for dollars so they can refocus on mission. At least half of the discretionary dollars are in acquisition, some say up to 60%. With that, the big dollars are going to be found through the acquisition process. It's really an undervalued lever in terms of both efficiency and performance right now.
So do you help government just streamline the way they procure things and that's where the savings are? Or what's your, you know, how would you know you're delivering value?
So it's everything soup to nuts. So as an example, we have recently worked with a customer in the intelligence agencies, and we have an independently verified number of $2 billion of savings that we help them find through changing their acquisition strategy.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes it's at a very strategic level, working with really senior folks in the agencies. It could also be actually helping them run their function. We also have acquisition training. We have some interesting simulation gaming training now that we're working on, and we do about half of our work in the intelligence environment.
You sound really passionate about this. When did you join the company?
So I joined the company 2 years ago. I thought that I was going to take over in July, but found out a couple weeks after I got there that I was pregnant. So we pushed that back, and I took over in
Pushed
December.
The pregnancy back? Or
No. and I took over in December of that year. So I've been running the company for about a year and a half.
Why are you the ideal pick at this time, and don't be modest, to run this company?
So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a third-generation entrepreneur. And I really am passionate about public service, extremely. So the combination of those two things to try to turn this company into an organization that is really entrepreneurial to help the government right now is something I really want to do.
But the company is very successful, 17 years, big employees,
True.
Lots of money. Why go entrepreneurial at this stage?
So the government needs something different now. They need a different type of focus. They need folks who can be creative, who understand cross-functional needs of the government. So we're leveraging what we already have in terms of all the expertise and the brand and the products. We have a virtual acquisition office that serves 25,000 people a day with information. But we also have an entrepreneurial spirit to really help them to be creative in the way that they do their work.
So I'm curious about the third-generation entrepreneur. Tell me, what were your grandfather and father doing?
So my grandfather owned 5 different blue-collar businesses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a vegetarian, so I hate to say this, but he owned a butcher shop. He also owned a bottling company, and he owned a secondhand store. My dad was a partner in owned hospitals, and I've owned 3 businesses. The last one I sold in 2007.
What was it like growing up with all that business entrepreneur stuff going on?
I can't imagine my grandfather saying he was a businessman because he was very scrappy, actually. I just got a chance to see people who really love what they did, who were creative and put that to work, and got a chance to understand how businesses worked and how to serve in an environment.
Yeah, I can't help but notice the affection you have for your grandfather. What did you remember most of him?
Very high integrity, hysterical.
You have a great story about his integrity. Yeah, why don't you tell us?
Sure. So he was 103 when he died.
103.
And he my early years with him. He lived first very close to us and then with us. And I remember going to their my grandfather and grandmother's store, secondhand store. And I remember the story that he would tell, which was that when he first started the company, he went to an airline and said, I'd like to take all the bags that you are going to be throwing out because folks haven't claimed them, and I'd like to take one of my secondhand store and sell the goods. And they decided to give him a test. And what he didn't know was they were sending him into a warehouse to take a look at the goods, but they had cameras. And they said, just go to Section A. Don't go anywhere but Section A in the warehouse. And he did exactly that. He came back with the goods, and they said, you know, we trust you because you could have gone and taken suitcases from anywhere and you thought we wouldn't have known. And the integrity that he had in that really served him well.
Tell us about your first job.
So I think my first job was working in my dad's hospital.
And how old were you?
I was 11, and I was working, that particular summer was medical records.
Wait a minute. You started working in a hospital at 11?
I did.
And they put you in charge of medical records?
Not in charge.
Okay.
Just filing. hot summers in Los Angeles. And I got to work with some really wonderful folks, but worked hard and got to see what it was like to work in that setting where you're filing records all day long, and really got sort of insight on how the hospital worked and how professional services worked.
What else did you do there at the hospital?
Developed x-rays when they used to have actual x-rays.
And so how old were you when you were doing that?
Gosh, I was, I don't know, I was a teen.
Young?
Yeah, I was young.
So looking back on it, how do you think you were impacted and shaped by all this?
By both my grandfather and my father, and my mother as well, who's incredibly entrepreneurial. And she's, I mean, Sheryl Sandberg would love her. You know, she got her PhD while she had two young children and a full-time job. People didn't do that back then. I remember walking down the hall from my room in the middle of the night, you know, to go grab a drink of water. My mom was sitting in the study reading to get her PhD, her master's and her PhD. Just the work ethic, the belief that you can accomplish anything and put your mind to it, the importance of working with other people collaboratively, and just an understanding of the sort of full scope of how businesses run, you know, the nuance of businesses.
Yeah.
So you have this rich entrepreneurial background, but I happen to know that you spent some time in the Pentagon. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
So that was the most challenging and the most rewarding job I ever had. Coming from California, I really knew no one who had a military background. It was in the height of the war. I was there from 2008 to 2011 working with the wonderful three-star running business transformation to try to get our guys and gals home. They were trying to fix Bogdwell and trying to really push cost consciousness because Chief Casey at the time was very visionary. And I'll tell you, it made me a better person, a better citizen, a better consultant to have sat in the government seat and had struggled with the issues they were struggling with. And
well,
I have an incredible respect for them.
What made it tough?
It was just a very, very challenging time, first of all, just for the military. You know, nothing I was doing was anywhere near as hard as what they did, right? I'm a nickel cheaper than anyone in uniform, for sure. And gave me a real appreciation for what that environment was. Definitely toughened me up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Came home every day for the first 6 months in tears, and I'm a pretty tough cookie. It was a pretty tough environment. But also going into a military environment as a senior executive without any military background, surrounded by folks who I was, you know, working with 4 stars and 3 stars and so forth. And it was, you know, you had to really hold your own and be able to help them.
Did the lessons of your grandfather come in handy?
Certainly the integrity and standing your ground, which he certainly did. But I think also the issues around collaboration, focusing on what was right, not just what was easy. I think those definitely did, yeah.
So what is your definition of an entrepreneur?
You know, you see an opportunity, and you see the art of the possible, and you believe that you can get there from here.
What makes entrepreneurs different?
Wow, that's a really good and hard question. Well, I think, first of all, we don't like working for other people. We think we can do it ourselves. So we're pretty independent as
a
group.
Right.
But I do also think it is that we don't believe there are limits. And so I remember a story when I was growing up, part of my family is Russian, and my mom, who Sheryl Sandberg would love, but the story Sheryl would not love, was about a evil czar who kidnapped a princess. And the prince who was in love with her had to climb up these stairs to this castle in the sky. And under each stair was the soul of the person who hadn't gotten past that stair. Mm-hmm. And they would say, can't do it. You're never going to get there. No one's ever done it. And every single stair was someone who had not gotten there. And he had to just continue to go and continue to go. And I remember my mom saying, you know, you can't listen to the folks around you. You got to just follow your heart and get it done.
That's a great story. When did you hear it? How old were you the first time you heard it?
I don't know.
But it stayed with you all this time.
Name my son after the story, actually. So,
what's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
Parenthood.
What makes it so tough?
Frankly, the balance. I mean, I live in Annapolis, so I have a 3-hour commute round trip every day. I've got a 19-month-old and a 9-year-old who have needs for their parents.
Right.
And I'm running a $60 million company, and that balance is tough because I want to be a real mom. And so I think every day I try to make sure that I'm getting that balance as close to right as I can, and some days it works and some days it doesn't. But that's definitely the most challenging job I have.
Would your mom be surprised at your success?
No, I don't think so. I think my mom has always, I think she's encouraged both my brother and I to reach for the stars. To
great.
Get to the clouds.
What's the website address, Kim?
It is www.asigovernment.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Kim McCabe, who's the president and CEO of ASI Government. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan and Dana Theus for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Dennis Fox, who's the president of a company called the Client Development Institute. What is the Client Development Institute, Dennis?
Thanks for asking the question. The Client Development Institute is an organization that's mission is to predict and enhance people performance.
Predict and enhance people performance. Tell us a little bit more about the predict.
Well, if you look at the prediction side, it has to do traditionally with psychometric assessments rather than just human gut feelings. We use objective tools to help HR folks, presidents, CEOs, sales VPs, mm-hmm. anyone who wants to make a better informed decision about who they're going to try to hire and put into their organization.
Okay, so you're critical to helping select talent.
That's part of it.
And then what do you do?
Then instead of leaving them there and just become a vendor of tests, we help onboard, develop, retain loyal employees who beget loyal clients.
And what do you like most about what you do, Dennis?
The fact that we really get into a total solution and not just, you know, bifurcate things or silo things. People want to make sure they get the right people on board, but then oftentimes they're not sure of how to take them to the next level.
Do you specialize in a certain category of employee, mid-manager or sales professionals, people like that?
You know, you don't want to be the master of everything, you know, the jack of all trades, the master of none. Excuse me, let me correct that. But our main focus is in Salesforce productivity. Having said that, we do a lot of work with the executive level, mid-managers, supervisory, and even frontline associate levels. But our focal point is around Salesforce productivity. If you had to say, what's one that defines you, and my own personal subject matter expertise.
Great. What's the website address?
www.clientdevelopmentinst.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dennis Fox, who's the president of the Client Development Institute. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan and Dana Theus. And for this segment, we have Ahmed Ali, who's the chairman and president of Testa Science and Technical Corporation. What is Testa Science and Technical Corporation, Ahmed?
Sure. Testa Science and Technology Corporation is a small business located in Rockville, Maryland that focuses really on the cybersecurity and information assurance and security world. Our primary clients are all federal government agencies and state and local and commercial entities.
When was the company founded?
I founded the company in late 2005, and we were going into our eighth year of business, and we've seen double-digit growth every year.
So how big or small are you today?
Approximately 150 people, give or take a few people. This year we'll come to a little over $20 million with a larger portfolio than that, but that's our annual run rate.
And you were telling us in the green room it's not just double-digit growth this year, it's triple digits.
Not triple. You know, that would be great. But I think we're on track to double this year. We have a lot of great things in the pipeline that we're very confident will come through.
So at a time when government's budgets are shrinking and government contractors, you hear them laying people off all over the place, you're doubling in size.
Yes, we are. We built a phenomenal team. They come with a lot of great experience. We've developed some key relationships in the industry with a lot of large businesses and small businesses. And those relationships have developed over time, and those big companies and small companies keep coming back to us. They like our transparency, they like our level of integrity and the level we bring to the table.
What makes for a good relationship?
A good relationship, like I was saying earlier, it's really transparency and integrity. If you're going to tell somebody you're going to be able to pursue something, you have to be able to follow through, because companies really don't have time to hear other teaming partners saying they would like to do something or they can do something and they don't follow through. So commitment is very strong, and it's a key element to building strong relationships and success.
So why start the business in the first place?
I've always had an entrepreneurial nature. It started when I was in the military, then I worked at large companies and small companies as a government employee, and it's something I've always wanted to do, not only to continue to serve my country and serve our government, but it's also a way for, as a business owner, grows his company and becomes a little bit more financially secure, to give back to the community. And I've always had a passion to give to the community, and this has enabled me to do a lot of that.
So you said earlier you were the first entrepreneur in your family. Take us back to when you were becoming a man. Mm-hmm. What did you want to be like the rest of your family or not?
No, you know, my family, I come from a very humble and modest background, and I was growing up, I was the only child. And most of my family members, you know, grew up to be professionals as they are today, either doctors or engineers or lawyers. And, you know, but most of them are federal government employees or government employees in the state and local side. And I was the first one to really break away from that and pursue a different track in the IT world. And
when did you notice, how old were you when you started rebelling against the family model?
I think it was in high school when my mother didn't let me play football.
So she didn't let you play football?
Didn't let me play football. She didn't want her only child getting hurt. So I started surrounding myself with a lot of interesting friends who had a lot of good backgrounds. When I was in high school and college, I learned a lot about the military, business, different practices, and that enabled me to shape my thoughts and who I am today.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Maryland my entire life, except for when I was in the military from 1995 to 2001. I was stationed in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and did three tours overseas while I was there.
What was it like growing up in Maryland?
In Maryland, I grew up in Prince George's County. To us, it was really tough. When my parents came here in 1976, we moved around a lot from apartment to apartment. My parents worked very odd. My dad's an electrical engineer by profession, but you know, when he came here, he had to start all over. Mm-hmm. So he worked a lot of odd jobs. My mom worked a lot of odd jobs. So we, you know, bounced back from apartment to apartment, and we had a really tough upbringing. Mm-hmm. And when my father finally landed a secure government job, he was able to prepare us for and give us a better life. I went to six different elementary schools, so that was interesting. Two different junior high schools, two different high schools. So it was,
what do you think you take away from all that moving around? And
you know, when you're going through that, it's really challenging. You're not really sure who you are as a person, where you're headed in life. Mm-hmm. But you know, as I've gotten older and I've been more educated and I've become more mature, it helped me really appreciate, you know, what my parents did and what I went through, because it's humbled me a lot. Mm-hmm. I really know how to look at somebody and understand their background and really understand where they come from and really understand their personality, because, you know, everybody has different personalities, and it really helps you understand how to communicate with someone.
So you've come back to your family as an adult, and you have a really interesting project with your father. Would you tell us about it?
Sure, absolutely. When I was, you know, I had an older brother that passed away, so my father was always very active on helping children's causes, donating to children, helping children who didn't have parents or, you know, who were abandoned or their parents passed
away. Even when he was just coming into this country trying to make his way, he had these interests?
Yeah, he did, because my brother, elder brother passed away in Bangladesh, where my family's from. So when he came here, they wanted to give me a better life. So one of the missions my father took was to build an orphanage. A couple of years ago we talked about it, and I said, you know what, I've watched you my entire life doing good for the community and helping children's causes, so I want to help this become successful. So in the last few years, we started an orphanage in Bangladesh where my father was born, and I'm very proud to say last year we grew the orphanage to 50 children. So we take 50 children, live there. They're educated there, they're fed there, they're clothed there, and there's a few teachers and instructors that take care of them. So these are kids who are either, you know, their parents passed away or they're abandoned and they have nowhere to go. So we want to give them a better life.
And you did this with your father?
I did that with my father. I helped, you know, a little bit with the strategy, yeah, financially, but he's really, he's taken on the lead. So he's kind of the lead on that, and I work.
What's that experience been like for you? And him.
It's given me a whole different perspective on life. I'll be very honest with you. You know, recently I saw the 50 children in a picture.
How about that?
Yeah, that was a very moving experience, very moving experience emotionally. So When you see something like that, it's enabled me to become more determined to continue supporting our current orphanage, but also to help it continue to grow. And hopefully we can replicate that model and maybe do it in another country, maybe in Africa, maybe in South America, maybe even in America in some areas where children need help.
Yeah. You talk about one of the benefits of being entrepreneurial is this notion of giving back.
Absolutely. One of the things my father's always taught me is that, you know, if you do succeed in business, he was always worried when I went into business, but he said, if you do ever succeed, do something positive that people will remember you for and where you can make a difference. Because people are not going to remember that you were a CEO or a president or chairman. Nobody really cares about all that. What they're going to remember and take away from their relationship with you and getting to know you is what you've given back to the community and how you made an impact in their lives, whether it's personally or emotionally or professionally.
Do you remember the first time you ever made money as a kid?
First time I made money as a kid is I used to shovel snow and I used to cut grass, and that was I think that started my entrepreneurial nature, because when I got that first I think $5 from my next door neighbor, I was like, wow, it's that easy? It's just a little bit of physical labor.
And what did you do with it?
I started saving in a little piggy bank, and you know, as a kid I used to be into video games a lot, so I first started wasting it on video games. Then I decided, you know, that's throwing away money, so I started saving. I bought my first bicycle, and I think my parents were really proud that he's actually, you know, saving it to try to buy things for himself. So
you spent some time in the military, correct?
I did 6 years active duty in uniform.
Uh-huh. And what was that experience like? What do you take away from the military?
Like I said, one thing I've learned in the military, because I've served in this nation in uniform and I've done 3 tours overseas, one of the most fantastic things that I've taken away is working around so many people with so many different backgrounds from our service and our nation. But as we've traveled overseas, you get such a greater appreciation for people of different cultures, different religions, different backgrounds, different personalities, and you really appreciate people of different backgrounds. And I think it's humbled me a lot and helped me understand how to interact with people at a better level.
Where did you get mentoring for that, do you think, or the influence to even be open to the diversity?
Definitely my father. You know, he was a huge impact in my life and mm-hmm. one of my closest friends. So I saw how he interacted with people. He's traveled, and I've noticed it's made a difference on him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was in the military, even when I go to third world countries in the military, and I see children of, you know, who are having trouble and families struggling, I always come back to thinking, you know, this is what my father is trying to help solve. And it's continued to humble me.
Yeah.
What surprised you most when you started the business?
You know, what surprised me most is the people that actually went out of their way to help me. I mean, I went out on a limb, on a risk, and I tapped into my old contacts and people I worked with, and everybody said, you know, Ahmed, we really enjoyed our friendship, getting to know you, working with you, and yes, if this is what you want to do, let us know how we can help you.
How about your toughest moment up till now, looking back on it all?
The toughest moment in business?
Business or personal?
Personal, so two-part. On the personal side, you know, having an operation after I got out of the military, that was a setback because I was very athletic and I had some limitations. That took me a while to get used to, but I'm a very optimistic guy, so I was able to continue forward. On the professional side, you know, financial is always tough. You know, how do you make payroll? So when I had to make my first payroll, I had to take a home equity line against my house and tap into my, close my 401k and shut down my savings. And my wife didn't know a lot of that I was doing. So that was challenging. And when she found out, she wasn't too happy about it. But, you know, it all worked out at the end. So that's
And how about your proudest moment?
My proudest moment is, I would definitely have to say, is my kids. You know, you know, the military changed my life in one respect. Business changed my life in one respect. But and the orphanage definitely changed my life. But I got to tell you, when I had my own children, it gives you a greater appreciation not only of life, but gives you a different focus on life as well.
Great. What's the website address, Diamond?
The website address is www.tistatech.com, TISTATECH.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Ahmed Ali, who's the chairman and president of Tista Science and Technical Corporation. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Dana Theus. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight, sponsored by Verisolve, a company specializing in marketing, public relations, and branding. Joining us for this segment is
Jordan Levin.
And Jordan, what company do you represent?
U-Report.
Tell us a little bit about U-Report.
U-Report is a product that's very revolutionary in our business of property management. It's a product that will revolutionize the communication in property management, the communication between property management and the tenant and the maintenance person. It is a new phone line. It's a new way of accessing your property manager.
How'd you come up with the idea?
Well, I run a property management company, and we've realized that we have a breakdown in communication and accountability. And U-Report serves all of our needs.
And you founded U-Report, is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
What do you enjoy most about this effort?
What I enjoy most about this effort is that we are taking something that is broken, a system that is broken of voicemails, emails, and text messages, and we are adding accountability to a system that never existed ever before.
How can someone learn more about U-Report?
They can visit us at ureport311.com.
ureport311.com. We've been speaking with Jordan Levin, who's the CEO of U-Report. This is Peter Schwartz from Vistage, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan and Dana Theus. And joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Jason. Jason, why don't you just tell us who you are?
Hi, this is Jason Bloomberg. I'm a president of ZapThink, a Dovell Technologies company.
Thanks for joining us today. What is ZapThink?
Well, ZapThink is an industry, IT industry advisory and thought leadership firm. And we are a subsidiary of Dovell Technologies. So Dovell is a U.S. government contractor in the Tysons Corner area of Northern Virginia. And I'm the president of the ZapThink division, which means that I get to go around the world running training courses and speaking at conferences. So everybody else is working on government projects. I'm enjoying life around the world.
And what do you guys train on?
What my training focuses on service-oriented architecture as well as cloud computing. So I have a 4-day SOA course, a 2-day cloud computing course.
How did you come up with the company? I mean, what was the idea?
Well, ZapThink was founded about a dozen years ago, back in 2000, and I joined in 2001. And we were an industry analyst firm, so we were focusing on market research and advice for software vendors who were interested in web services and then service-oriented architecture. And then in the middle of the decade, we shifted our focus to the enterprise end user, so the architect, and that's when we developed the training courses.
And how big or small is the company today?
Dovell Technologies has about 100 people, but the ZapThink division is still very small, so it's really myself plus some additional people who help on occasion.
Okay. And so you had a partner, and you guys were sitting around one day, and you think, you know, this is a great idea. Let's make a business out of it.
Well, he founded the company, so it was a one-man firm when I joined, and I had been in IDC as an industry analyst in 2001. So when it was time to make a move, I started working with my business partner, Ron Schmelzer, and business took off at that point. So
why is this business so fascinating to you?
Well, it's an interesting subject because we don't just talk about, you know, SOA and cloud computing, but really about all of the different trends impacting enterprise IT. So, in fact, that's the topic of my latest book, The Agile Architecture Revolution. It pulls together mobile computing and the organizational changes impacting the organization and tries to focus on how, you know, how IT can really help the organization as a whole become more agile.
So, you know, for the average listener, tell us about, in your opinion, the power of IT and as it relates to the organizational effectiveness.
Well, there's a IT is undergoing a huge transformation, or you might say multiple transformations, right? So it's not just a bunch of big computers anymore. It's cloud computing, where you're outsourcing your computers, service-oriented architecture, where you're taking your legacy technology and making it more flexible and supporting a variety of business processes. And then the rise of mobile computing as well, right? We have computers in our pockets that are more powerful than supercomputers were just 20 years ago.
Right.
And we just take it for granted. And so now the larger organizations are struggling with how to manage all these different trends and how to pull them together and how to provide real business value.
Right.
So, Jason, you get paid to think, right?
You could say that, yeah.
Okay, so how old were you when you first realized that thinking had value?
Well, I mean, you know, back in high school, my focus was really on doing well in my studies, and my interest primarily at that point was mathematics. So, I really, was very good at math.
But did you see that it had real world value?
It wasn't really about the real world value. It was just about the intrinsic value, just of being interested in the subject matter.
But then you told us about a story later when you were in a PhD program where all of a sudden you realized that if things didn't have value in the real world, it didn't have your interest so much.
Well, that wasn't really what happened. It was more that I was interested in, you know, I did graduate work in philosophy of science, and I was interested in the subject matter, and I found that academia was more interested in the politics.
What, philosophy and science?
Philosophy of science.
What is the philosophy of science? What is that?
Well, I was studying history and philosophy of science, but my focus was really on the philosophy of physics. So it's really understanding the fundamental nature of reality. So it was a great topic to be able to study. You know, when you
and why do you have to know that?
It, just for personal edification.
Yeah, I know. What is it about you that really is driven by that kind of curiosity?
I know. I just found it fascinating. I found math fascinating. I found philosophy of science fascinating, and now I find fascinating.
At the youngest of ages, just being really curious about the really deep questions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What were you like as a kid?
Probably really nerdy.
Where'd you grow up?
Albuquerque, New Mexico.
What was that experience like?
Well, I couldn't wait to get out. Albuquerque was not a pleasant place back in the 1970s,
Well, tell us a little bit about that because it helped shape you.
Well, Albuquerque, if you've been to New Mexico, most of New Mexico is beautiful, and they have great mountains, and you have the pueblos and everything else. Albuquerque is just one big strip mall. And it's grown, so it's an even bigger strip mall from when I was there. But there's really nothing much of interest in the city, right? The only interesting things were what you would do if you left town. So we went dinosaur hunting back in the desert, and you'd go up into the mountains, and that's what was interesting about Albuquerque is leaving Albuquerque.
Okay.
Do you remember how young you were when math started to click for you and you thought it was really interesting?
It always was. I don't know. I can't remember a time when it wasn't.
And was there any influence in your family, other mathematicians or people who helped point you to it?
Well, my father had studied mathematics, although he was a clinical psychologist. So he didn't, you know, he studied it as an undergraduate and then, you know, changed to psychology in graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have some genes.
So all this fascination with knowledge and things like that, you'd think you'd find a part-time job in a library, but you tell us about a story about selling encyclopedias.
Well, and during college, when you're looking for a summer job, you really just need to get anything, anything that you can get. And I was visiting my girlfriend at the time in Ohio, and I needed to get the summer job. And so I was just in Ohio, and it was during the recession of 1982. And so you start looking for a job, and you can't find a job, but you only have a few months, right? Because it's a summer break. So it's like you got to get a job right away, or just the summer will be gone. So I started selling encyclopedias door to door.
And tell us about that experience.
Well, if you can sell encyclopedias door-to-door, you can sell anything. It was very difficult. You had to learn a 45-minute memorized presentation. You had to memorize it because you were actually hypnotizing the people. You'd go into their houses. You had to figure out how to get into the door, how to get them to listen to you, and then how to get them to sign the contract, write a check, and then how to get them to not cancel during the 3-day rite of rescission, right? So the hypnotism had to last for after you actually left. And it was – so it was challenging, but I managed to sell, I don't know, 6 or 8 sets that summer, so it paid better than minimum wage.
But 6 or 8 sets, and how many people did you actually talk to?
About 3,000 houses, yeah.
So that's a heck of a ratio. How did you deal with all the rejection?
You just keep going. That was the most valuable lesson. I mean, that's anybody who's into sales or anybody who doesn't like sales, that's the problem with sales.
Was that the thing you took away from that, was how to deal with rejection?
How to deal with rejection in a sales scenario.
So fast forward, where has that paid you dividends in your current business?
Well, I don't really see my role as sales, but, I'm in an executive role, so sales is an integral part of what I do every day. And, during the ZapThinks independent period, of course, there were just two of us. We had to sell all the time. So, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a small business person, even if what you're doing is not sales, you're still always doing sales.
Right. Tell us about philosophy a little bit and your favorite philosopher.
Well, the philosophy of science is a very analytical approach. So, of all the different kinds of philosophy, it really drills down to the fundamental truths. So, we studied a number of philosophers of knowledge and philosophers of language and philosophers of science. I don't know if I have a particular one that's a favorite.
Well, you tell us a good story about Albert Einstein.
Yeah, Albert Einstein, he wasn't really a philosopher. He was a scientist. But the reason I told that story is that as a young man, even before he had a university position, he was a clerk at a patent office in Switzerland, and he wrote 3 scientific papers, and they revolutionized 3 separate areas of science. So he did this as a young man without even a university position, and it wasn't just one area of science. He actually changed 3 entire areas of science.
And what about that story impresses you most?
Well, that anybody could do that, right? Anybody who's really smart, in spite of the barriers in front of him, can have that kind of impact.
You did a lot of teaching out of school. Do you still see yourself as a teacher?
Yeah. In fact, I taught right out of college for a couple years before grad school. And then at grad school, I would teach as part of the grad school program. And then I went back to high school teaching afterward. And now, I teach as part of what I do. I run courses around the world. So my teaching experience from kindergarten all the way up through business calculus and night school, it comes in very handy, right? I have a lot of, I pull on that experience. But it's nice not having the 8th graders, It's nice having adults in the classroom.
What has kept you interested in teaching to be still doing it today?
Well, it's sort of thought leadership in action. It's one thing to go up and speak at a conference. I'm there for 45 minutes, and maybe people find it interesting, maybe they don't. But if you're in a classroom, 4 solid days, that's a lot of time, right? It's a fire hose of information, and you really help people understand something that's important to their careers, and you get into some real depth. So, you're actually not just, talking head, but you're actually making a difference in their lives.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is?
Oh, toughest thing I ever accomplished. Well, I don't know. I survived my divorce. That was pretty tough.
You did what?
I survived my divorce.
Okay.
So I got remarried. So that was pretty tough.
Okay. How about your proudest moment up till now?
Proudest moment? Well, I know I'm proud of my 2 kids, I guess. So,
And what's the website address, Jason?
Our website, ZapThink, is at zapthink.com, ZapThink.com. And you can find the Agile Architecture Revolution at, predictably, agilearchitecturerevolution.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Jason Bloomberg, who's the president of ZapThink, A Dovell company. Sorry about that. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Dana Theus, for helping me with the interviews. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Verisov, a company specializing in marketing, public relations, and branding. Joining us for this segment is
Fletcher Gill.
And Fletcher, what's the organization that you are CEO of?
Well, thank you for having me on. The organization is called Luke's Wings, and we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization that provides flights for the families of our wounded warriors who are currently recovering at military hospitals across the country.
How did you come up with the idea?
A good friend of mine, Sarah Wingfield, actually met a wounded warrior at Walter Reed named Luke Shirley. And after she told me his story of how he had lost an arm and a leg, I decided to start a nonprofit that provided flights to bring their families in so that they would be surrounded by love and care during their long and difficult recovery. And so I named the organization Luke's Wings after Luke Shirley and Sarah Wingfield as a testament to the two of them.
Why is this so important to you?
It's important to me on multiple levels. I think that, I think it should be important to everybody. If you've ever been in a hospital bed without your family, what it would mean to have a family member by your bedside. If you've ever lost someone who you cared about and wish you had five more minutes with them, this should speak to you. And, of course, because it's our service members. They're the people that deserve it most. They've put their lives on the line, and they've sacrificed so much, in this case, in battle for us, for our freedom, and for that we owe them everything.
Great. How can someone listening in who would like to support Wounded Warriors through your organization help out?
There's a lot of ways, and thanks for asking. The first is to visit our website at www.lukeswings.org and make a donation. If you have a phone with you, you can simply text the word WINGS, W-I-N-G-S, to the number 80888. Again, that's 80888, and make a quick $10 donation.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Fletcher Gill, who's the CEO of Luke's Wings. This is Peter Schwartz, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Dana Theus. And for this segment, we have Frank Sherman, who's the CEO of Transportation Management Services. What is Transportation Management Services, Frank?
Transportation Management Services is a passenger logistics company, and we facilitate the movement of thousands of people for an event, either coming into a venue or when they leave. For example, in a London Olympics, we would move the athletes or move the attendees or move the officials around in a timely manner.
And when was the company founded?
1995.
And how big or small are you today?
Today, we're about 2,500 employees.
Wow. So you're one of the largest ones out there.
We're the largest privately owned transportation company in the States.
That's quite an accomplishment. Why start this business?
Well, in 95, a couple years before, I had a business failure, and after my business failure, I went and bought a marina, and it was fun to do, and I liked the sunsets, but it wasn't going to feed my family. And then a friend of mine who was a client by the name of Patrick Person called me and wanted to open a donut shop, and I knew nothing about donuts, and neither did he, so we decided to do something we both knew, and that was a transportation company.
And how did you come to know about transportation and moving people around?
My parents had a business where they would move government employees from the Washington, D.C. area up to New York and Boston, and the name of that company was Carter Tours, after a hotel chain called Carter Hotels. It's no longer around. But we would have people call the home making hotel reservations, and we would facilitate their transportation up and down the East Coast.
So how old were you when you were answering the phone?
Well, we probably were answering the phone and working in the business before the age of 10. Uh-huh. I mean, doing something.
So in the ripe old age of 10 years old, you become a transportation logistics specialist.
No, I kind of grew into that. We first would hire other people's buses, and we used Trailways a lot. I always like to say I grew up singing Edelweiss on a bus to senior citizens on a Trailways bus. And then from there, my father owned a bus company, and then later I got into it.
So looking back on it, what was it like to grow up in a family where the business was that close to the home life?
Thinking back, there was a lot of hard times because you're really on duty all the time. You're always working. Customer service was inbred to you, and to the point where at that age you think it's a real drag, and it's not until later in life when you find out that it's part of you.
You tell a great story of watching your mom type out a purchase order while she was doing something else.
Yep. I remember being often my little brother would been in a little rolly thing, and she would be having one foot on him, keeping him moving and keeping him quiet while she typed out reservation forms on the typewriter.
So I'm wondering, so it seemed like a lot of work as a kid, but was there any moment when you were a child when you said, I want to do this when I grow up?
I used to repeat to my dad saying, you know, I'd like to take over your business someday.
Why were you thinking of that at that age?
Well, I just felt like I understood it. I was very comfortable doing it. I liked making my own schedule, and the harder you work, then the more you're rewarded. Normally, you had failures where you would work, put your blood, sweat, and tears in it, and at the end of the day, you had nothing. But most of the time, you get rewarded for the amount of work you put into a project.
So did you go off to college?
I studied in Frostburg.
What'd you study?
Business.
Did you?
Yeah.
And then after college, what did you do? Go back into the family business?
I bought a bus company, and actually...
At what age?
I was about 23.
When you bought your first bus company?
Yep.
How'd you get the money?
A leverage buyout from a company. They were having a little problems. They were struggling in the D.C. area. And I grew it. It was about $22 million, grew it to about $23
million. So you did a leverage buyout at 23. How'd you get the investors to believe in you?
The people selling the bus company financed most of it.
Yeah, but what did they see in this 23-year-old that made them believe that this would be a good transaction?
I think the fact that they knew I was local, I was already purchasing bus transportation, so they knew that I knew the market.
Still, though, a 23-year-old, that's pretty impressive.
Well.
Looking back, what did you bring to that party that maybe somebody else couldn't?
I knew the Washington area, and I knew how to go and develop business with our clients. I would go and cold call, and we would see the bus out in the morning, and we would, when our clients got on the bus, we were there welcoming the client onto the bus. We really followed it from cradle to grave.
So that's the transportation side of it. Where did you learn how to lead companies and lead people and run businesses?
Well, my expertise when I started the business was more on the transportation side, and my father used to have, you know, thousands of people. You know, you'd have 1,000 people on a big bus move, and we had to learn to efficiently get everybody on the right bus timely. My partner at the time, Patrick, came from a local destination management company, and so he was used to doing high-end jobs in D.C., whether it be the Reagan building or whatever building it was. And when a lot of people came out at a time, we found our strengths were to facilitate the people onto the bus, and that's what our niche was.
Great.
So you were an entrepreneur in your home life as a kid, but you took it out to school. Tell us a story about the first time you started making money.
Well, when I was probably in fifth grade, my dad had a lot of extra office supplies, extra rulers and erasers and cool
things
pens.
Fifth graders need.
Yeah. And so I would borrow some of his extra office supplies, and from my desk I would sell my rulers and sell my pens, and I was doing pretty well. And then I got in trouble with the school because the school store was complaining that I was stealing their business. So as my punishment, I had to go to work for the school store.
So what'd you take away from that? Get out of the stationery business?
Yeah.
did you give your dad a cut?
Nope, I didn't give him a cut. He found it to be funny. I still got in trouble, but.
So when you started Transportation Management Services, you started off with a big deal. Tell us about it.
When we started, we leased an office right here in Tyson's Corner, and I was doing cold calls, and Patrick was working on proposals, and the first big job we won was Comdex in Vegas, a several $100,000 job, thousands of people, and we knew the operations manager, the owner of Comdex, said either if you do a good job, you'll be off to the races with your business, and if you don't do a good job, your business will be over.
And you succeeded.
And we succeeded.
And you had, I mean, you tell us this great metric of the difference between you and the people that went before you. What is it?
The Comdex, normally we're used to having complaints between 1,500 and 2,000 complaints for the job. They received under 15 complaints when TMS did the job.
How did you do it?
We planned and planned and planned, had the right staff. The back of the house was a little crazy, and to the client, we stayed calm.
Yeah, you've been doing this for such a long time. What keeps it fresh and fun for you?
Well, we have a lot of employees now, and I get to relate to we bought a big section of companies from a bankrupt company that was run by a bank, and I'm being rewarded every day by working with the bus drivers and the mechanics and the people at the ground level that I think can relate to me and I can relate to them, and they're developing the culture change that we're trying to encourage in them, and that's customer service and safety.
Great.
So when you were starting the business and you were doing this cold calling, did you target Comdex and say, that's one we definitely want and can definitely do, or was it a bluebird? Or?
I really didn't know about a pipeline back then. We really went through the Las Vegas Convention Visitors Bureau, and we just called every convention there was. And when Comdex called back, we were a little surprised. And we brought in a team of people, friends, to help us brush up our PowerPoint skills. And we did mock presentations, and we were really ready when we went into the presentation, and the guy looked at the PowerPoint and said, that's nice. I want to learn about you.
So you've had businesses that have failed and businesses that have succeeded. What's the big difference in terms of building a success or a failure?
I think the biggest difference would be the financial controls you put in place and understanding financial statements and actually doing them timely and not kidding yourself and making excuses month after month. That starts a dangerous trend, and finding yourself behind the eight ball 6 months later.
So across all the years, what are you most proud of?
I guess I'm most proud of the service reputation that we have by our clients, that really they can give us a project that has there's zero chance for failure. You cannot fail when you have thousands and thousands of people coming from all around the world to an event, and they trust that with us.
Great. What's the website address, Frank?
TMS.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Frank Sherman, who's the CEO of Transportation Management Services. I'd like to thank my co-hosts for the day, Colin Callahan and Dana Theis. And we've had a great lineup of guests. Colin, why don't you go through that for us real quick?
Yes, we had Kim McCabe, President and CEO of ASI Government. We had Ahmed Ali, who is the Chairman and President of TISTA Science and Technology Corporation. And Jason Bloomberg, who is the President of ZapThink, a Dovell Technologies company. And Frank Sherman, CEO of Transportation Management Services, Inc.
Great. And don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be talking to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.